Seeing everyone. And I wonder how many of you came from Pretoria yesterday. I believe there were flash floods there. I had visions of you coming in flippers this morning, but I take it things have subsided. On the one hand, we do want rain, and on the other hand, not so much so fast. I mean, that's the whole issue. But of course, humanity is never satisfied. Anyway, you know, it's good to see you all here this morning. As you know, we still haven't replaced the committee assistant, Mr. Denver Woodington, who really, you know, you may not have realized, is highly qualified and has been appointed as the, I think, the executive secretary to, is it the divisional manager? Well, an interim, never mind, he's there. And that recognizes his skills and background, which is always healthy to hear that these things are finally being recognized. Just before you adopt, I put this forward for the adoption of the agenda. The Honorable Montash was at the launch. We were invited, and of course we were all busy with our PCOs, with constituency work, but as she's in the area, she attended the relaunch of the revitalization of an industrial park called Queen Industria, and I asked you just to give us a 2-3 minute input on that before tea. So that includes that. We've got the subcommittee here, we've got the continuation of engagement on the liquor policy, consideration of minutes, committee business, and adjournment. Right. So let's start with the adoption of the agenda, please. Thank you, Honourable Williams, seconded by seconded by the Honourable Kronoff. Let's get a few other people other than members of the ANC. Is there any objection to this agenda? No. So I see no reason why you shouldn't be seconding it then. So let's try to be a committee rather than a parochial spaza shop somewhere. Well, I don't know, perhaps you frequent it, I don't. Right. Now that this is adopted, I know you've been looking, yes, but not me. I have better things to do with my life than look out for shipping. We're going to now have apologies. We have, just looking here, apologies, I don't see any on here. In fact, I don't have any apologies forward, and you don't either, Mr. Medema. Mr. Herman? Mr. Mkongi, where is he?
He's here. He stepped out.
Oh, he is just stepped out. Let's hope he steps in. Right. The report back then, from the Subcommittee on Legislation Dealing with Debt Relief, Consideration of Terms of Reference of the Subcommittee. The chairperson of that subcommittee, Honourable Williams, please take us through. I understand you're distributing something, are you?
Chairperson, we've distributed the...
You have distributed the... Right, and you're talking to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the and committee, the subcommittee on legislation dealing with debt relief met this morning, and the main point that we were discussing this morning was the terms of reference with regard, and we have distributed the draft terms of reference which we are putting forward to this committee today for adoption. The meeting was very short, I must say, because there was total agreement in the terms of reference. There was one change added to the terms of reference, and everybody agreed to that. And so we'd like to put this draft terms of reference before the committee for adoption, Chairperson. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. No, we do hear that you went through it, but this is the committee. We haven't studied them. So it would be rather helpful if you just took us through it.
Thank you, Chair. With regard to the terms of reference, the objectives that we are looking for in the subcommittee is to consider viable debt relief measures, to unpack policy and legal challenges related to debt relief. Now, with regard to these, the committee hasn't discussed in any detail at all what would viable debt relief measures be. What we basically have worked on so far is to get the terms of reference down and adopted by the committee so that we can work along these lines. And so the objectives, and I'll continue with those, is to invite experts to comment on debt relief, and also we want to make recommendations to the portfolio committee in that regard, and also to propose draft bill. We want to initially come up with the memorandum of intent that we will send to the executive, or first to this committee and then to the executive, before we stand at the end of this quarter. So we haven't really discussed any of these things. Mainly we've discussed the terms of reference and how we can adopt those terms of reference. And we've done that today.
All right. Yep.
We're recommending these to the committee. Thank you.
Right. They are here for us members of the committee. We have a subcommittee that has interrogated it. So for those of you who are not aware and have forgotten who's on the subcommittee, it's the Honourable Williams, the Honourable Jordan Hill Lewis, the Honourable Mantashe, and we had thought, Honourable Advocate Alberts, you were going to be sitting on that committee, one of you there, and now I'm looking to you now, because it meets on a Tuesday. I think generally, is that not right? At 8:30, is that right?
No, that's incorrect. It has so far, but the next meeting is tomorrow at 10:00.
All right. Generally, its set day would be 8:30 on a Tuesday, but it does change, as you know, Honourable Alberts, from time to time. Could you just comment on that, please?
Madam Chair, if the committee wants me there, I'll be available.
I think it's rather helpful if we've got at least three parties involved there, you know. Thank you very much. And, of course, as we learned from the Honourable Oriani Ambrosini, the late Honourable, some years back, well, you know, Chair, anyone can sit there. You sort of parachute in any time. But that's why we also said you should sit there from time to time to catch up on things. Am I not right, Honourable, you know, it's a new member, and I always have to check names here, and I don't have Miss Honourable Van Sculpet. But I understood, Honourable Mkongi, you did help out on the Friday, didn't you? Thank you. All right, on that note, the terms are before us. Can we please have somebody other than the Honourable Williams, preferably other than anyone sitting on that subcommittee, to propose adoption? Now, you're sitting on the subcommittee. I said other than someone. Because, you know, you're bringing that to us. Can we have somebody, Honourable MacPherson?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to propose the recommendations as put before us.
Thank you. Can we have someone to second? Yes, Honourable Munskolfeg. Can we?
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to second the proposal. Thank you.
Right, so there we are. You can start putting on your roller skates now and get cracking. All right? And thank you very much, Mr. Hermans, for being there. And we must ensure that there's no breakdown in communication in future as to when you are sitting, the venue, and the time. Please, it's important. We don't have much time left, that you work efficiently. Now, we've done that already. Well, that was quite speedy. Now, at 10 o'clock, we've got the update by the National Consumer Tribunal. And I'm just getting Don't worry. We've got quite a huge bank of people here. In attendance, Ms. Bosch, whom we have met, the group operating officer. Thank you, seeing you here again this morning. We also have the ICT manager. Is that Mr.?
Yes,
Mr. and it's B. Nomverte. Yes. And then we have a Mr. P. Moodley, acting registrar. And then we have a Professor Bonke Dumisa, deputy chairperson. Thank you for being here this morning, all of you. Thank you. Yes, we're going to just advise people that they do have the PowerPoint, and please go straight ahead. And because Hansard doesn't know who you are, just give your name. We know you, you're speaking now. If anyone else speaks, just say X, and then carry on. Do go ahead then, Chief Operating Officer, Ms. Bosch.
Honorable Chair, Ms. Fabs, and the honorable members of the Portfolio Committee for Trading.
And you're not Ms. Bosch, are you?
Yes, I'm about to explain this. I was asking for that permission to go in first so that they will follow.
Don't worry.
Okay. And I want to also, through you, Chair, to thank the DGI people who are in attendance here. What I'm going to try and do in less than 2 minutes or less than 5 minutes, I'm just going to give an overview of what we're going to say, and then Ms. Bosch is going to continue, as well as Mr. Bucks, and Mr. Moodley. We want to start by appreciating the support of the Portfolio Committee and the DTI. We are a very small organization of 42 staff members and 12 tribunal members. Let me apologize for the absence of our executive chairperson, Mr. Ted Blanche, who is not here because of pressing adjudication commitments in Pretoria. We are trying our best to deliver on our mandate. We've had 4 clean audits, as you know, and our workload has yet quadrupled over the years. If we look at last year, for example, we had 19,000 debt rearrangement orders and 195 cases for hearing. If we compare that with this year to date we already have 24,000 debt rearrangement orders and 200 cases for hearing. Our NCT team of experts, starting from Ms. Bosch, is now going to deliberate on these issues. I said, thank you, Chair, for allowing me to go in first.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, so I'll take us through our presentation. As I did previously on the first slide, I'm just giving the acronym. That's more for reading and to explain the presentation slides as and when we use the terminology. I then also go through a few pages where I just very briefly explain terminology that we use in our environment. When we talk about an allocation, that means to give a matter for hearing to a single member or a three-member tribunal panel for hearing. Close of pleadings is a period which transpires when a matter is basically ready to be allocated for a hearing. From the time that a filing is complete, there's a set period of time during which pleadings are open. During this period, the parties are then allowed to file an answering and a replying affidavit. A condemnation application is an application which a party must bring to the tribunal when it does not follow the tribunal's rules. Examples here is if, for example, an answering affidavit is filed outside of the time period, then the tribunal must condone this non-compliance of its rules on application. If the non-compliance is not condoned, then that step will be in the regular step and disregarded if it does not happen. Now, interlocutory proceeding applications and condemnation applications is one of these types of applications
are applications and proceedings that deal with the rights of the parties between the commencement of an action and its final determination. Examples of this would be, for example, an application for an extension of time for submitting pleadings, amendments to pleadings, additional answering and replying affidavits, where parties will seek direction regarding how to conduct their cases, if they want to compel the other party to comply with the tribunal's rules, or if they require interim relief or another remedy. The complete filing is a terminology that is used that means that all of the filing requirements as set in the relevant legislation have been met. This then signals that the pleadings are open and the parties can file their answers and ultimate reply. To be noted that when we indicate to parties that the filing requirements have been met, it makes no determination on the merits of a matter. It just means that that matter can be adjudicated on. All right. Then if we look at the debt rearrangement applications, which is the bulk of the applications that the tribunal receives, these are matters that is brought to us by debt counsellors, where consumer debts are rearranged as agreed with the credit providers. Now, although this is an agreement that the tribunal looks at, they don't just do a rubber stamping of it. They actually have to scrutinize and interrogate these settlements quite carefully, as from time to time they may contain illegal interest rates. Instances where, for example, a consumer in fact did not consent to what is being put forward, where amounts that have to be repaid are in excess of what a consumer can afford, as well as some further examples there. Now, non-debt rearrangement matters are all the other types of matters that can be brought to the tribunal. They, in most instances, require a three-member tribunal panel as well as a formal hearing. If we look at the National Credit Act, there's approximately 53 types of prohibited conduct and 34 types of applications that can be brought to the tribunal. An example, there would be a referral of prohibited conduct by the regulator, or, for example, a request for a statement from a credit provider which can be brought by a consumer, or to resolve a disputed entry on a statement. If we look at the Consumer Protection Act, there's approximately 99 different types of prohibited conduct. Examples here would be issues of quality of services and goods, warranties offered on repaired goods. These are often quite complex matters, as it involves also new legislation where there isn't necessarily guiding precedent. And in to date, all the instances that the tribunal has heard in relation to consumer protection matters come to the tribunal as a result of non-referral notices that was issued to consumers as opposed to matters referred to by the regulator. Now, this slide, and I showed the similar slide in May, this one has now just been updated with the current year to date. This shows the growth in our caseload. From the period 1 April 2016 to 21 October 2016, the tribunal has received 24,446 cases. This is 3,349 cases more than our entire caseload of 2015-16. So from that, one can then determine that in all possibility for this year, the tribunal's caseload will again double from what we perceived in the previous year. Now, as we've indicated previously, also our financial resources over the past 3-4 years have increased on average by 12.93%. Our staff complement increased from 41 employees last year to 42 employees for the current year. And our tribunal members reduced from 13 to 12, with one member resigning in this specific year. All right, so that's just basically putting everything in writing, what I just now shared with the committee. Then if we look at slide 11, this is just a breakdown of our cases. If we look at the 24,446 cases that we've received in this year up to 21 October, you'll see the majority of these cases, 24,211, is debt review application, and then 234 is non-debt review application, and one matter is what we call an other matter, which is an application in terms of our rule. Alright, so the parties who can bring applications to the tribunal is of course the regulators, the National Affairs Regulator and the National Consumer Commission, consumers in some instances directly, service providers, and then registrants in terms of the National Credit Act, can then also, for example, if they disagree with a decision of the regulator, bring that decision to the tribunal for review. If we look at the non-debt free arrangement matters that has been filed also, I then on slide 13, I break it up in between the different legislation. You will see that we've received 18 matters in terms of the Consumer Protection Act. These 18 matters are 16 non-referral matters and two referrals that were made by the National Consumer Commission. We've also received 219 matters in terms of the National Credit Act. Of them, 3 matters were filed by the National Credit Regulator. 5 matters were non-referral matters that consumers referred to us of the receipt of the non-referral notices, and 211 other matters, which will then, for example, include matters where consumers request copies of their statements, or where there's a disputed entry or a review of a sale of goods, just to give some examples of the other category. On the next slide, slide 14, I then basically further break that down. So I've already indicated the types of filings that we've received in terms of the CPA. If we look at in terms of the Credit Act, we have received 2 applications of the failed alternative dispute resolution, 1 review of sale of goods, 50 applications for variation or decision of tribunal orders, at least the 5 non-referrals in terms of the National Credit Act, 60 non-referrals in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, 1 application for interim review, 152 requests for the production of the statement, 1 application to resolve the disputed entry, 1 consent order application after the resolution through an alternative dispute resolution process, and 1 application to limit obligations in respect of frivolous, vexatious, or unreasonable requests. Okay, so if we look at currently the tribunal has 22,824 current cases that are not yet finalized. These matters can be split into 182 matters that are non-debt arrangement matters. Of them, 47 was filed before this current financial year, and 135 was filed during this financial year. Of the 22,642 is debt rearrangement matters. Of them, 5,132 was filed prior to 1 April 2016, and the remainder in this current financial year. Look at our finalized debt rearrangement application. In this current financial year, we've issued 12,032 orders on debt rearrangement applications. These matters were all issued through our motion course with the resounding success. The assessment of these matters are intended to act the motion court as a service to the parties, no longer prior to the adjudication process. Turnaround from date of filing to the issue of an order is on average year 91.4 days. Overall, our turnaround to also finalize these matters is then 5.13 days from complete filing. We have, however, requested permission to amend this specific KPI on our scorecard that we count from date of filing as opposed to date of complete filing, because the complete filing is part and parcel of the adjudication process at this stage. Generally, we receive very positive feedback from filing parties in relation to the motion forms. Now, if we looked at our finalized non-debt rearrangement applications, we have finalized 213 non-debt rearrangement cases during this financial year. Of them, 100 was filed during 2016-17 and 113 filed before. How they've been finalized is 50 judgments issued, 2 condemnations refused, 75 matters lapsed for not meeting the filing requirements, 9 matters were settled and confirmed, 4 were struck of a roll, and there were 73 withdrawals. So just specific in terms of NCR cases, we currently have 40 current matters. We've also finalized 43 NCR matters during 2016-17. if we look at those matters that were filed before 2015-16, okay, there are 12 of those matters that are still current with us. We finalized 16 of them. Matters that were filed during 2015-16, there's 52 of those. Of them, 25 was current and 27 was finalized. And matters filed during 2016-17, there are three matters and they are all three still going through our processes. Okay, if we look at the current matters, so I'll just look at each one of those here then separately. The 12 matters that were filed before 2015-16, one of them is undergoing a condemnation process, one matter is set down for hearing, one matter is set down for a pre-hearing, eight matters have been postponed or held in abeyance, so we cannot proceed with them any further because there's either outstanding high court applications or they could have an appointment. And then on one matter there's a judgment outstanding. Okay, if you look at matters that was filed during 2015-16, the 25 current matters, three of them pleadings are open, four is undergoing a condemnation process, seven of these matters are being held in abeyance because of high court applications on related matters, and then 10 of these matters are either set down or to be set down. It includes one pre-hearing and two rules. 16A applications. A Rule 16A application is an application to amend your pleadings, and then one judgment is outstanding. Okay, and then if we look at the three matters of NCR that were filed during 2016-17, two of them is currently undergoing a combination process, and one of those matters has been set down for a pre-hearing. So if we look at our turnaround on the NCR pending or current cases, this is the average as of 21 October. For the 40 current matters, the turnaround there is 330 days from filing, and from close of pleadings, 235 days. To be noted that on 39 out of the current 40 matters, they have or either have had a condemnation, amendment applications, postponements, or intervention applications. One of the 40 matters had no interlocutory application. And then just as to show you about our motion board there, our process and the access, I've indicated on that slide all the areas where we've had motion board so far. Of course, what also drives where we will have our motion board is where we receive applications from their councillors. Oh, but with the motion board in general, we do try and also go to all the provinces where we receive applications. Okay, so some highlights and achievements, as Prof. Mesa indicated earlier on, we've received our fourth successive 10 audits. We are currently implementing quite a successful automation program, of which I will, with the chief's permission, ask Mr. Nongwete to just take us through some items on the automation program, and that we are quite happy to report that with this innovation that we've implemented, as Mr. Nometi will take us through, we will be able to deliver on our mandate within our allocated resources.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As our CEO, Ms. Bosch, has indicated, with the ever-increasing or exponentially increasing volumes, particularly of our debt rearrangement cases, we actually, in the 14-15 financial year, embarked on an automation program to assist us with those volumes on efficiency in that regard. In 15-16, we went live with our system, and our current system, slide number 25, shows gives you a layout of our current system. So essentially, if I start from the left, the filer can either file by a number of methods. They can either email their applications through to us, fax them, post them, or more recently, we have a walk-in center at Centurion where they can actually come and capture their applications through templates. And that is fed directly into our case management system, which then essentially processes the applications and generates the necessary output for the motion course process, which our COO has already ran through with you. That indeed has created a lot of efficiencies and allowed us to effectively and efficiently track our cases, the status of our cases, where we are with our cases, which ultimately provides much more accurate reporting on how we're doing in terms of our cases going forward. This system has been in operation, as I say, for the past 12 to 18 months, and now we're moving to the next stage. The next stage of our system, which is on slide 26, is really to introduce an e-filing process to allow the filing parties to directly submit their cases into our system from wherever they are in the country, and also to be able to submit those cases either by capturing the information into our system through the templates, or by generating an electronic file, which they simply send to us, and then our system will detect that electronic file, will ingest that electronic file into our system, and will also validate to ensure that all the relevant information in terms of the legislation has been complied with. And immediately, if there's a non-compliance or if there's some documents missing, the system immediately, in real time, will notify the filing party of the incomplete filing. But not only that, it will also notify the party in real time of what actual document is missing, or what additional information needs to be submitted into the system. The system, the e-filing system that we're creating, also caters for electronic payments. Now, what we'll do is, for DRA applications, we have a filing fee of 200 rand per application. Now, essentially, now what the system will allow is for the filer to electronically pay into our bank account a lump sum, and then submit bulk applications, and as the applications are processed, the system will automatically deduct 200 Rand from the bulk payment that has been made by the filer. When the bulk payment that has been made by the filer reaches zero, the system will notify the filer in real time and ensure and indicate that the filer must replenish their balance in our bank account. We have an electronic interface link with our bank now, so that we can track the balances of all the filers within real time. In order to move to this system, for the e-filer, we will have a registration capability. You will see on slide 26, the first thing is that the filer will need to register on our system with all their particulars. And they will have a secure method of actually signing onto our system, which will be unique to them, so that we manage our security very carefully. We've taken into account security as a very serious issue when we designed this system, given the ever-increasing threats of viruses and breaches on electronic systems. So essentially, now the filer will be able to log in, sign on, make their payment, then submit their application electronically, either through capturing of template of information via templates, or by simply sending an electronic file. It will go into the system. The system will process the information, and then the final output will be the complete or incomplete notices. And then with the assistance of the tribunal members, the necessary order, either granting the order, refusing the order, or the directive. This will have a significant impact in terms of cost-benefit, and as our CEO, Ms. Bosch, has explained, will allow us to do more for more and also our acting executive chair has explained will allow us to do more with the resources that we currently have without asking for additional monies or additional resources. Thank you.
I think just before I also move on to the next slide, just to assure the committee, you will see there on the slide that we indicate about on-site services and self-service. We've been quite sensitive to the fact that we don't want to reduce the accessibility of the tribunal to those consumers who might not necessarily have access to electronic means, which means even though we are implementing e-filing and automation, we will still allow people to file with us using the normal route that they are currently using. And we will then also, our first center is now at the tribunal's offices. And that we will then allow, give the equipment to filing parties so that they can use that to capture their application into the system at the tribunal and thereby still ensure that we are then accessible to all. Alright, so I thought it was quite important to share with the committee some of the impacts of the tribunal decision. Now, the tribunal provides redress to consumers on the one hand directly. That is why, for example, confirming a debt rearrangement application, ordering a refund or issuing a certificate of prejudiced conduct, which a tribunal can use to go to a high court and get the damages that they suffered as a result of prejudiced conduct, as well as indirectly. Now, the indirect redress is by, for example, the cancellation of registration of credit providers, debt counselors, and so forth, taking those people out of the system, creating certainty about the interpretation of the legislation by making declarations of previous conduct and reviewing decisions of the regulators, as well as by interdicting prohibited conduct, stopping it from occurring. Right, then some specific of cases that we believe is quite groundbreaking decisions, and these decisions, and I'll explain as I go through them, has also put significant money back into the pockets of consumers. For example, if you look at the Barker decision, which was, I think, one of our very first big decisions, this decision was also upheld by the Supreme Court of Appeal. The tribunal indicated that credit providers, in the specific instance, the credit provider used more than one agreement to ultimately let consumers pay more than the 50 rand service fee as provided in the Act. So the tribunal said that is, prejudiced conduct, and they ordered that all the money that was charged of consumers in excess of that 50 rand must be refunded to consumers. Another big one was the Bournemouth decision. This was a debt counseling matter where the specific debt counselor, who was also an attorney, what he used to do is after finalizing the debt review application of a consumer, he would let that consumer pay the monies into his attorney's trust account, he will take collection commission on it, and then he will pay it over to the PDA. So the tribunal said, no, that's not how to do it. If you, depending on, there's nothing wrong with both being a debt counselor and an attorney, but you need to be quite sure what hat you are wearing, when you are doing what you are doing. For the debt counseling, you cannot also charge all kinds of other fees, and they ordered a refund of all those fees. So that decision was also upheld by the Supreme Court of Appeal. Now, of course, these decisions get appealed all the way there because of the monetary impact that it will have on these parties, which is in the billions. The exact figures, I'm sure, that the NCR...
What the financial impact
is that one? Chair, the NCR will have the exact figure, but I think it was more than 20 million. So that's just to give an idea. And of course, what also happens with these decisions, we might make that decision for that specific party, but other parties out there who have similar practices will also then apply the law as we've interpreted for them. We look at the Lewis matter, which is a bit more recent. There we looked at the instances when parties may charge disability insurance, credit insurance, and those instances when a credit provider will be allowed to charge a loss of employment insurance. Of course, here the tribunal found prejudiced conduct on the part of Lewis, and they've indicated that an audit must be done to exactly see what who are the consumers affected, and then they must, of course, be refunded. The tribunal also indicated in their order that even those consumers who have paid off their loans with Lewis, that Lewis must then track them and give them the money that they, you know, get in excess. Now, of course, this decision is before we also indicated that once we have that information, they will come back to the tribunal so that we can determine the administrative penalty, because, of course, the number of consumers affected would be one of the factors the tribunal will take into account in determining what would be an appropriate penalty. This matter, however, currently was taken by Lewis on review to the High Court, so it will go a similar process, I suspect, than the other matters that I've mentioned. Another matter that I thought was just a groundbreaking decision is the matter of MTR versus Life and Cash Loans. This specific matter is, at this stage, MTR, I don't know, had a lot of filing quarters and were just not paying their registration fees. The specific matter, the tribunal looked at the law around, you know, about payment of your registration fees, and found that in those instances where a registrant do not pay their registration fees on or before the due date, the registration would lapse. So there's no need to even bring an application to the tribunal to cancel registration because it does not exist anymore. So that's why I said these decisions have also shaped the regulatory environment and created by the president. Now, the tribunal has also looked at some examples where they've impacted more directly on individual consumers and provided reasons on an individual basis. First example I gave you is the case of hygienic toilets versus NCC. This matter, the tribunal set aside a compliance notice against a small service provider. Specific service provider had a small business in terms of which he would hire out mobile toilets. In a specific instance, a party came to him and said they had a big event for an executive mayor. They want to please if they could hire his the toilet facilities for disabled people. He cancelled business so that he could assist them. He wanted the event to be a success. And then ultimately, on the last minute, the service to the person requesting the service cancelled. So he's in charge of cancellation fee. In terms of the compliance notice, he had to return that fee. But the tribunal said in this specific instance that no, you know, that is not correct, and they cancelled that compliance notice. Matter of Kutzer and Berger versus Young. This is a matter where the tribunal ordered that a refund for services not rendered must be provided. This specific matter, the consumer had a business idea of a little sponge that you would take with you to, if you are not quite satisfied with the state of, for example, a hotel room, you could use this little sponge to sort of do the housekeeping yourself. And he then asked the respondent to do a marketing plan and services for him, but these services were not rendered to quality. The tribunal said then, you know, you must refund this person his money. Matter of Jarvis and Alberante Motors. In this specific matter, the consumer took his vehicle to for repair to a service provider. The vehicle came back and the repairs were not done to quality. In actual fact, when the tribunal looked into this matter, from the information provided by the expert witnesses here, it seems that in doing the repairs, the service provider did not follow best practice in relation to how one should be doing those repairs. And ultimately here, the tribunal ordered that the consumer must be provided with a genuine replacement engine for his vehicle, so that you know, that the vehicle would be in working condition. Then in the last matter I have on this slide, the Lazarus matter, this specific matter, the consumer ordered granite tops, and he was informed that this granite tops would be heat resistant, so he put hot plates of some sort on top of this granite, and then within quite a short period the granite cracked. Now, the supplier indicated to him they are not liable because they didn't indicate it is heat proof, they said it's heat resistant, but the tribunal found that, you know, there's a certain, a reasonable consumer would expect that this granite should be able to, then if you say it's heat resistant, at least take some heat, The plate wasn't directly on the granite. There is a small space between the hot plate and the granite, and therefore the cracking is unreasonable. And that here they ordered a refund in lieu of replacing the defective granite. And the reason there was also because if you look at natural stone, the color won't necessarily 100% the same and matching. So if they would say you need to replace the granite, it won't necessarily put the kitchen back into the same state that it was before the granite cracked.
Sure.
Alright, so then just in relation to administrative fines. Now, administrative penalties serve as a deterrent to previous conduct, however this must be balanced. The factors that the tribunal must consider is set out in the legislation, and the tribunal also always considers submission that is made, for example, about employment, how many people are employed by a business continuity. It would not be helpful if the tribunal orders an administrative penalty and then actually the result of that penalty is 200 people without a job. Alright, so during 2016-17, the tribunal issued administrative fines to the value of 995,000 rand. This includes matters where the fines were issued as as part of a settlement between the NCR and the filing party. In total today, the tribunal has issued administrative fines in excess of 7 million to various parties. We get refunds. The tribunal orders refunds in terms of matters where refunds are due, for example, where there's been an overcharge of fees. However, the exact amount of the refund is normally determined via an audit, which will then be overseen by the NCR. This is more in relation to the regular matters. Now, then just some general information about our costing per case. Now you'll see there, if you look at our actual cost of per case for 2015-16, that was 3,842 rand on average per case. Now through our motion court process, that is reduced to 1,556 rand per case. Now, what we can also indicate in this slide, with our anticipated ICT intervention, as well as continuous motion courts, we anticipate that by 2019-20, our cost per case should be around 451 rand per case. Alright. Now, our financial resources in respect of the next NCF period from 2017-18 to 2019-20 should be sufficient despite our current increased caseload. This is due, as I said, the implementation of our motion courts, the fact that we are hearing more than one non-debt rearrangement matter per day, and we are also increasing the number of debt rearrangement matters that our tribunal members can do per day. Our filing fee increased on the 4th of February this year, from 100 rand to 200 rand, our anticipated future ICT enhancements, cost saving on other line items, for example around travelling, as well as digitization. We are currently sending tribunal members, for example, the case file via electronic means as opposed to making copies that we then need to courier, as well as the approval of rollover funds that we receive by National Treasury to be used for our future operational cost requirements. However, and I will just now show on our next slide the figures that we've utilized to plan our budget. If our caseload is very unpredictable, increase way beyond what we've budgeted for, then we may find ourselves in a position that we may experience difficulty in achieving our mandate, but this is not something that we anticipate. Okay, so this slide shows our case numbers per case as we've budgeted. Now, the anticipated number of cases to be filed with the tribunal in the future is predicated by using the trend of what was received in the past, as well as other economic indicators such as debt levels, interest rates, and so forth. Our caseload is the biggest driver of our cost pertaining to our variable expenses on our budget. Now, our case numbers were calculated based on the following. Okay, it's been calculated by firstly establishing a baseline for the next 3 years in order to establish this baseline, we looked at our anticipated case numbers for the current financial year, and then increased that of 100% from the actual number of cases that were received from 2015-16. All right, this increase of 100% is also in line with the increase that we've experienced from 2014-15 to 15-16, which was 99.7%. And then also taking into consideration that for the first half of this year, we've already received, you know, basically a bit more than the same number of cases we received from the previous year. Then we step down this increase to 90% in relation to debt free arrangement applications for 2017-18%, 80% for 2018-19, and then 70% for 2019-20. This was to anticipate in the higher number of cases, which this calculation is based on. Now, whether or not our case numbers will actually level down from a percentage growth perspective from year on year is something that we do look at every year. All right. Now, from what we see, however, is that our numbers will continue to grow, and that has also been the trend that we've been experiencing over the past years. Now, the non-debt free arrangement matters do not have such a clear pattern as our debt free arrangement pattern, therefore we've applied a consistent 50% increase going forward over the NCF period. And then similarly, because of this higher base that is used for the calculation from previous years, we anticipate that our cases will increase from 230 for the current year to 569 for 2019-20. Now, when we look at how we split up our costs in relation to non-debt arrangement applications, we said 45% of those will be Section 148 and Section 165 cases, which we group to about 4 per day. And then we also then said that the other cases predominantly will be able to on average use 2 cases per day, and then there would be a few what we call big cases. And that is about, we said, 10% of the cases that we will get, where we would need 3 days per case. That is, for example, for some of the bigger cases that the regulator bring to us, where they actually cannot finish the adjudication in a single day. Now, if we look at our budget as per our agreed, you'll see our grant allocation is budgeted according to the NCF allocation. And we've already received an allocation letter from National Treasury indicating the allocation of the NPF period. Then the additional grant donor funding back line represents an additional grant of 3 million rand that we received during 2016, and rollover funding of almost 6.9 million that National Treasury has approved for us to use during 2016-17. All right, our other income consists of filing fee income that is calculated according to the number of cases that we budget for, as well as interest income that is calculated according to the cash flow forecast. The filing fee for the debt arrangement matter, as I've indicated, increased from 100 to 200 rand as a forfeit. Now, if you look at our compensation of employees line, this is budgeted according to our staff structure. And for purpose of our budgeting, we remained on 43 staff members over the NPF period. Compensation of employees has also been included with an inflationary adjustment over the NPF period as per the Treasury budget guidelines. And we will therefore have to enhance our ICT systems and case management processes to be able to handle this anticipated increase in our numbers with the same number of employees, which is what we've showed the committee just earlier. Now, the biggest driver of the variable component of our goods and services are adjudication costs relating to the budget case numbers, as was already explained, and these costs have been calculated taking into account the planned enhancements to our CMS. Our ICT international enhancements will be crucial for the tribunal to be able to deal with the high caseload that we anticipate receiving, both from a human resource perspective as well as from a financial resource perspective. We have also then looked at cost-saving initiatives and efficiency gains to contain costs and to ensure that we can operate on our available resources, and this was also taken into account in this budget. And if you look at the capital expenditure line, that is then mainly anticipated plans, and it's mainly ICT assets. All right. Now, our judgments, as I said, are available on the website as well as on Chatly. And our contact details.
Thank you very much, Keen, from the National Consumer Tribunal. Thank you. So just before I take questions and comments, let me welcome the DDG of Consumer Corporate Regulation Division, Ms. Anyetsi Tenzi, Ms. Quenna, Director representing the Chief Group Operating Officer, and I see a few others from DTI, am I right or wrong? No. Of course, we get so used to Ms. Naidu as well. But we also have with us here the from Parliamentary Legal Services, one of our senior advocates, Ms. Charmaine Vandermeer. Thank you very much. Right, members, on that note, 2 minutes each. You can see how much people pack into their comments in the BRRR in 2 minutes, and I realise that's more than enough time. Right. Honourable Williams, Honourable Van Schalkwyk, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Elbert, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Esther Hazen, Honourable, yes, Kornhoff. Honourable Mkongi, yes. Thank you for that. I see everyone starting off with Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. First, I just want to welcome the presentation. I just have one question. It's around slide 29 and slide 30. About the orders that you give out and also the administrative fines. I just want to know, in your experience, have you ever had a situation where companies just budget for these fines and then just carry on practicing what they're doing? And also, has the tribunal ever ordered or fined a company for something that's exactly the same? So it's repeat offenders. Do you have repeat offenders? Thank you.
Thank you. Right, the Honourable Mantashe. Was it Mantash? Van Schalkwyk. Apologies.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to join the previous speaker in welcoming the presentation. My concern was relating to the increase of your budget versus your increase of your caseload. Do you think, according to the projections that you have over the next few years, that you'll be able to sustain the demand in terms of your caseload that you are projecting, looking specifically at your budget and also your human resource, taking into consideration that you've improved your human resource capacity with only one person, but also with regards to service delivery to the needy people in the rural areas. Can you give us some broad outline on how you plan to address that issue in order to make services available to the rural areas? Thank you.
Right, thank you. Honourable McPherson.
Thank you very much. I'm just interested in that case, hygiene toilet versus NCC. Can you just let me know which political party that was and which municipality that was? Thank you.
That was a quick one from yourself, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Elbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'm also interested in that case. It's quite interesting, but I just looked on your website. I can't find it there at all. So just kindly help us to find that hygiene case. Then regarding the change in your procedural rules, about 2 years ago, your procedural rules changed out of the blue. What I want to know is, did you notify the role players who regularly deal with you, like the NCC? The NCC told me that they submitted the holiday clubs matter to you without you having any information on your website that your rules have changed, without you ever communicating to them that your rules have changed. And once they've submitted the case, they only realized then that you, once you contacted them, that they have used the incorrect procedure because your rules have changed. And as a result, that case is now in abeyance because they have to go fix all the procedural problems. And as a result of that, the holiday clubs are continuing their harassment of the public and consumers, left, right and center. And they are waiting for you to actually get your house in order so that they can actually submit the matter again. They apparently have to go back and start from scratch It took them a year to do research and submit the matter to you. Now they have to go back again, and it's now more than a year since the matter had to be withdrawn. So I want to understand what actually transpired there, because that is a travesty of justice as far as I'm concerned. And I also would like to know, why did you change your rules? Because I have heard from legal experts that your rules do not reflect the same logic as the procedural rules you would find in civil court, and actually that you require more actually than one would need to submit before a court of law. And why is that the case? It seems that the rules that is existence right now is not conducive to submitting matters to you. It is not conducive to allowing consumers to get their matters heard before you. And I would like to know exactly why that is the case from your side. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Albert. Honourable Hill Lewis.
I really associate myself with the comments of the previous speaker. I appreciate, ladies and gentlemen from the NCT, that you do your absolute best to try and make the system work with what you have and where you are. But, you know, if we just talk Turkey for a minute, the purpose of the NCT originally was to help ensure that all of these cases that consumers file or that agents file on consumers' behalf don't clog the court system. But we're now in a situation where it's actually much quicker to go to a court than it is to go to the NCT. Now, that can't be the purpose, that can't be the fulfillment of the purpose of the NCT. In fact, this committee, you will know if you follow our committee meetings, which I'm sure you do, this committee is considering legislative amendments to the National Credit Act to make the National Credit Regulator less and less reliant on bringing cases to you and giving them more power so that they can make the determinations which under the current legislation only you can make. And frankly, I support those amendments, because who wouldn't support them? If it takes so long for the NCR to get a single matter resolved for the NCT, it would be quicker for them to just make the judgment themselves, and if the affected party is displeased, they can take it on review in a high court. That process will still be finished quicker than we can get a judgment from the NCT. So I really associate myself with those comments and say, you know, unfortunately, appreciating that I'm sure that your team does the best it possibly can, the NCT is now in a position where you've lost the public confidence, you've lost the confidence of the market, the transgressors don't take you seriously, the committee doesn't take you seriously, and the NCR, who relies on you to enforce the National Credit Act, does not rely on you to, is not able to rely on you to do that properly. If we just consider the debt rearrangement matter, you've got 22,000 matters. Now, you've explained why some of them require some detailed inspection, but you know, still those things shouldn't take more than half an hour each, even with the inspection. Shouldn't take more than half an hour each to deal with. So, you know, to say that you're swamped with 22,000 people, if you've got a team of 10 people only doing debt rearrangements, I don't know how big your team is that's working on debt rearrangements, maybe you can tell us, but if you have a team of 10 people just doing that, that 22,000 will be sorted out in no time. You know, if you say that the enormous budget that the NCT is allocated from the public funds to deal with 186 cases, I say give that money to the Department of Justice and let's go to court on those matters.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Esther Hazen.
Thank you, Chair. Further what was said about Holiday Clubs, for example, many consumers lodge a complaint with the NCC, the National Consumer Commission, and there the same problems, both from the consumer and the credit provider. They complain that the commission documents are very poorly drafted, full of errors, conduct unprofessional, does not understand the various business models from the supplier, and fails to investigate and make inappropriate and premature decisions. Also, on the NCT, on the tribunal, has the power at any time to grant interim relief even before hearings have commenced. And it's a concern then that the people that maybe their house or their car might be taken back. But if people haven't paid for many, very long periods, they haven't paid. So there must be some protection in that as well. Credit is the cornerstone of any capital and democracy institution. But we also need to protect both ends. And we all, the credit counselors in this country is also, how can I say, aspects and obliques must affect that their morals are very elastic. They take unfair advantage of people, they tell them that there's fees involved, and a lot of people just walk away then and they sit with open documents.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Esther Hazen. Honourable Colonel.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to know, when you receive a debt a rearrangement application, have you ever received an application where they ask specifically for the writing off of debt? That's my first question. You know, what I want to ask, if not, why not? You know, why is there not a request like that? And then just secondly, I see your caseload went up, you know, quite dramatically from 2014 to 2016. You know, apart from the economic conditions we are in, is there any other specific reason? Were people trusting you and coming to you because of that? And yeah, thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Honourable Colonel. Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you very much, Mr. Just need clarity. On slide 24, on a highlight, you spoke about the success that you have, and at the very same time, you speak about caseload. 22,000 and so forth, and then the staff is one. I don't get the relationship that you speak about success. Do you want to say that the staff is able to make sure that you reduce that load? Because what I see, I only see 128 that you are doing, but it's still thousands and thousands of applications. So what is the relation between success and the continuing increase of the caseload? That is the first one. The second one is around the question of the automation process in relation to what you have just presented to us. I think that was what was presented to us is slide 25 and 26. Is this process in place now, or do you have another automation process before this one that you are proposing here? And what have been the highlights of the previous automation process? The last one is to, you speak about the average cost, the case, slide 31. I am confused about that. It is decreasing as it goes into outer years. What does that mean? Is in relation to what you have budgeted for as per a case cost? Or what is happening? Which is confusing. Because what I understand, the cost of living becomes too high as you go, but yours becomes too low. So what could be the relationship between the two? The last one is, how much does it cost a consumer to make an application?
Uh-huh. Thank you very much, Honourable Mkongi.
I have a couple of questions myself, and that is, are there any legislative amendments that are required to improve the work of the MCT? First one. The second thing are the three issues linked to the matters that were filed before 2016-2017 financial year. In which financial year were they filed, those matters? Secondly, how is the NCT managing the backlog? And thirdly, does the NCT use a first-come, first-served basis to process these matters and so on? The other issue is on a matter of quality, which could come before the NCT. does this apply to the workmanship after an accident, the replacement of certain items and components that they should be? Should they be second-hand, or if you're being charged the full price for whatever it is, a beading or this and that, shouldn't that in fact be a new item, as it were? And how is that dealt with, and how long does that take to deal with it? Right, if you would please address those matters for us, and try to do it, as it were, succinctly. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Now, in relation to the question about whether on the orders of the admin penalties that we've issued, in our experience, whether people basically just budget and then just practice for that, I think from our perspective as a tribunal, it would be, I mean, it would be difficult to say, as we don't investigate into, you know, into people's businesses to that effect. We look at the matters that are before us. I can say that is that we haven't seen any repeat offenders before the tribunal. So I suppose one can read into that, and from our side we haven't seen such an instance. Then in relation to the question about our increased budget versus our caseload and whether we're able to sustain the demand, that is specifically where the ICT interventions will be used with the tribunal. We anticipate that with the ICT interventions, it will place the tribunal in a situation where with our current resources, we will be able to then deal with all these cases. A big portion of the tribunal's costs are stable. For example, the rental, the employee costs. So that's not reliant on the numbers increasing or decreasing. So as the numbers of cases become more and those costs remain stable, only the variable cost of falls increase. That is why also you will see that because of this big increase in our cases that we anticipate, our cases actually become cheaper per case as the number goes higher. All right, specifically in relation to, just to maybe on that also, is because we will be become quite reliant on ICT intervention, that will then also put us in a position that we are, will be able to deal with our case, with our current resources. At this specific point in time, I know DCI is busy with the recruitment process for additional tribunal members, so we anticipate we will have a few more additional resources. That is, of course, one of the challenges that we've experienced, in the sense of that one can look at temporary resources to help with the operational side of managing our caseload, but you must be a tribunal member in order to adjudicate on a matter. So there, we cannot just easily increase our capacity. However, that being said, with the ICT interventions that we anticipate, we believe we will be able to, with the number of tribunal members that we have, to look after our cases. The matters of hygienic toilets versus NCC, this was a matter where it was an event for the executive mayor at that stage, and it was in the Mabufane district, which would be it was a business in Mabufane. As I said, that is the information that I have available on my side. In relation to the availability of the specific matter that I refer to, I found it on Saturday, but I can provide you with it. I have it with me.
Softer and softer. Could you just maintain your
voice? I think it's as I move back from the microphone. Let me
go
in here. Open here. Okay. Then, Albert, about our rules. Our rules, this change was
part of the regulation process. It happened at the same time that the regulations came out for the that was required in terms of the National Credit Amendment Act. So it was part of that whole process. Our rules specifically provide for that if a party filed with us and the filing is initially not correct from a filing requirement perspective, that we will then assess that application and we will inform an applicant what are the additional documents, for example, that they need to provide and what they, for example, what is a document or what are the specific requirements that they need to meet. The specific requirements for every application that can be filed with tribunal is set out in what is called Table 2 of our rules. So for each and every application, it in detail tell you what is the form you need to use, if there's, for example, a fee that you must pay, if there's additional documents that you need to file, what are those documents, and then if you need to go and serve, on who you need to serve, and to what extent. The purpose why we set out in that way is to allow consumers to come to the tribunal and be able to basically represent themselves. Legal representation is not a requirement at the tribunal, although you will often find that with the cases where the regulators are involved, those respondents, they will come with the big legal teams to come and represent them. So I haven't seen a case where one of the bigger respondents have been brought to the tribunal in actual fact does not have legal representation. All right, so now specifically I am aware in relation we've received two filings from the NCC prior to those two filings that we've received in this year. Of the two filings, the one matter, which was the Univision matter, that matter was withdrawn from the tribunal and after an high court application by a respondent there, all of that. So that was also something that happened outside of the tribunal. The other matter, which was the Eagle Trust matter, that specific matter, the tribunal was required, or the requirement that were that the NCC they had to meet was a service issue. And so they needed to give they were applying for a combination so that ensured that they were not required to give service of the application to all parties that is affected. Now, as of course of all things, in some instances, you know, as if you were a party that may potentially be affected by a specific matter, you do have a right to be informed of that matter. So I know that is where the challenge was in relation to that matter. Now, just in relation to the Univision matter case that I referred to, when that matter was withdrawn from the tribunal, just before that, it was set down for a pre-hearing to be heard. So it was going through our processes. Specifically in relation to our rules and why we had to change it, the changes that we made didn't change the filing requirements of any specific application. The filing requirements are the filing requirements, and that is based on the requirements of the legislation. So, to give you an example, if you are applying for the production of a statement, then the requirement would be, for example, you need to show the tribunal, we would require proof that you've actually asked the credit provider for the statement before you come to the tribunal. That would be some document that you need to file with the tribunal. A copy of the credit agreement for which you require the statement would be a filing requirement. So all of these requirements, as I set out, is basically taken from the specific the legislation. So that is... That was now what we did with the rule change. Those changes were necessary to also allow for the additional applications that could be brought to the tribunal as a result of the Amendment Act, and also to allow, for example, for e-filing and so forth. It also put the chairperson in a position where she can potentially make binding practice notes on parties to assist with the smooth running of our cases. It is so that our rules are not the same as court rules. I think one of the reasons why there would be a difference is a court is in general an accusatorial institution, whereas the tribunal is inquisitorial. Right, so our processes that we follow is different from court processes in that regard. Also, our rules are not only followed by legal practitioners. It is also followed by normal consumers and so forth. That is why we have, for example, this assessment process. Even though on the debt rearrangement matters currently we don't do assessment, if it is not a debt rearrangement matter, we actually go through that whole assessment process where we will explain to the parties what are the documents they need and they need to add. It's something you won't get in a court process, because in a court process one would expect the legal the legal provider to know what are the requirements. So that's basically part of the reasons for some of the differences between the rules. Now, I'm aware that it has taken, if one looks at the average turnaround, the tribunal quite some time to finalize some of the NPR matters. As I've indicated, there are some matters, I think, of the current matters, that is, I think, about 9,000. Yeah, there's 13 matters in total of the NCR matters that are basically just pending in the tribunal because they are currently going through a high court process. Now, some of these matters, they are basically pending in the tribunal. I think the oldest one is from 2012, which is basically, it's sitting with the tribunal, but we can't move it forward until the court process has not been finalized. So I think also on that note, although I've noted the comment that there's a perception that it's quicker to finalize matters in the high court than in the tribunal, from my own experience in the tribunal, matters are a little bit different on that specific instance. And that's also, as I said, currently the oldest matter that we have waiting. About the people who look at the debt rearrangement matters. As I've indicated...
I think maybe it's because your mic is not in front of you.
Is it better?
Yes, and raise your voice.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair. If we... open the slides. If we look at the size of the team that looks at our debt rearrangement matters, I have 12 tribunal members who must do both debt rearrangement matters as well as here non-debt rearrangement matters. So they are tasked with dealing with the complete caseload adjudication. We can, as from an office side, of course, do processing our cases and setting it down and so forth. There I can, if needs be, add additional resources. But ultimately, to adjudicate on our cases, that is the resources I currently have. We do anticipate that once this recruitment process is finalized that we will have a few additional tribunal members, but that will then be our adjudicated resources. Currently, through our motion course, okay, one tribunal member will do on average 32 debt rearrangement matters per day. All right, so I think around the 30 minutes, that's give or take, then we expect 32. Two in a day. Actually, we wanted to do them a little bit quicker. But as I said, there are quite a large number of orders they need to deal with. They also don't deal with the debt rearrangement matters full time. We normally have what we do like week-long motion courts. So half of the month will go towards debt rearrangement matters. We normally have 1 week in the Cape Town area because we've got quite a large number of debt counselors here. 1 week in the Gauteng area because there's also a quite a large number of areas, and then the third week we will then split up between the other provinces where there are less debt counselors, but we then also look at their matters. So that's how we do that, and then for the other week and a half they deal with the non-debt rearrangement matters. Let me just go further and go on to that. Okay, in relation to the debt rearrangement matters, whether we've ever received a matter where they ask for a writing off of the debt, talk to Misa, we'll answer to that specific matter.
Thank you, the Honorable Mr. Coroner. On whether we receive applications for the writing off of the debt, the answer is no, we don't, because the legislation does not allow us to write off debt. However, what happens through the process is that when we get these applications, when we see the interest rate is much high, we say we're not going to accept it, and the service, the credit providers, in most cases, adjust the interest rate immediately. We've seen many cases where the interest rate was 32% and they decreased it to as low as 0%, and that benefits the consumers a lot. And the reasons for increased DRA, there are two major reasons. It is much cheaper for the consumers to come through us because they don't need to come through attorneys. When they go to court, in most cases, it is the attorneys and then all those collection things. And as Ms. Bosch has said, we are much quicker than the High Court in dealing with these things. So at the beginning, attorneys are still pushing things to court, but people started realizing that it is much quicker and cheaper to do this through us.
I think just to maybe also echo there what Prof. Kim says, as indicated to the committee, from the feedback that we've also received from filing parties who participate in our motion court process and so forth, we've received quite positive feedback, and people indicating that they actually appreciate this. And then I think I might have skipped over the question about the needy in the rural area. Like maybe just now when I thought about the motion courts, it came up again. What our plans are is that when we go into the future, the ICT innovations, all of that would be for people who have access to ICT resources. Now, of course, that won't be people in the rural areas. So we will continue with our motion courts. So we will go to them. But because of the ICT interventions, that will place the tribunal then in a position where we can then, with our current capacity, send our tribunal members to the rural areas. What we also do, and this is now in relation to the sit-down hearing, so it's not the debt rearrangement matters, if we have parties who are in any place in South Africa, basically, that cannot come to the tribunal for a hearing, we go to them. So we will send our panel to wherever the parties are, and we then have the hearing there. Of course, depending on the matter, we might, and again now if people have access, we might do a hearing even over Skype or some other means so that people can come to the tribunal. I think that's also a key difference between the tribunal and the court, is we are quite informal in relation to how we reach people. We don't have a space where we sit and people must come to us. If we can provide a request by going to the area, then we do that. Okay. Then the link between our cases and the achievement, the success. I think for us, the success lies in the fact that I think Honorable Nkonke, quite rightly, as you've indicated, that we've been able to, with quite a small team, attend to a large number of cases, and we anticipate that we had to be quite innovative in thinking how will we continuously be able to deal with this large number of filings that we expect. And of course, our resources won't exponentially increase in the same way, but through our plans that we are going to implement ultimately completely, we will be in a position to, it doesn't matter how much the numbers will increase, we will be able to deal with them with our resources. So that's more where the highlight and achievement thing lies. Then about the current processes, I think let me just go to that slide again, which was this one about our current system. You will see there, if you look at that slide, the automation lies in currently the fact of when a party, if they file with us, that information is taken up in our system, which is then the automated portion. The adjudication side in the motion course are still quite manual, All right, but then ultimately the process thereafter, once we get the orders and all of that, that will then again become automated. So that's our current process. What we've implemented so far is basically the first portion of our process to make that systems based. The future part that we anticipate to implement, and we plan to implement that during quarter four, where we are right now, we've had a number of workshops with our filing parties about our intended automation. Of course, we want to take everybody along in this process, and that we're doing in this current quarter, so we plan to ultimately implement this in the next quarter so that it can be full on running from 1 April for the next financial year. Now, so that is basically our process as how we see that unfolded.
Just to, for you, Chair, to add to what the Honourable Mkongi asked, how do we achieve the decreased cost per case? We've been in operation for 10 years now, and because of that, we've accumulated the experience of adjudicating cases, whereas in the past, one single case had to take us the whole day. We've been able over the past 2 to 3 years to be, we've been able to lump the number of related cases into one day. So instead of hearing only one day, but in the past we had only one case a day, we are able to deal with sometimes more than 4 to 5 cases in one day. And what that means, we are paying the tribunal members a day. So now instead of paying them for one day to do one case, we find ourselves paying them for one day to put in that case. It is because of accumulated experience.
So I think, and then also, really just in addition to in addition to that also, as we've indicated, you also get to a stage where from an economies of scale perspective, your fixed costs remain stable, but the number increases, so per case, the portion that you apportion to that specific matter is then also less. Okay, then on the question about how much does it cost the consumer to make an application, most of the applications that come to the tribunal is actually for free. There are specific ones, however, that does have a filing fee. One of them is the debt rearrangement application, and that fee is 200 rand. Now, one can then ask the question, but if you're a consumer without means, you know, what then happens to you? Our rules allow for a process where if a specific consumer cannot afford that 200 rand fee, they can then write to our chairperson, and in that instance, she can even waive the fee. So that is how we can ensure that everybody who needs to come for a debt rearrangement application is in a position to do so.
We need to speed this up.
Okay. I'm going to very quickly look at your questions. We have looked at the legislation, and there are some legislative amendments that we think could assist us in being even more efficient.
And you let us have that back.
We'll do that in writing, Chair. If we look at the matters that we said it were filed before this current financial year, most of the matters on it, I can give you the exact numbers also in writing if you would.
That's exactly what
we would like.
Okay.
So there's three questions linked to that one.
Yes.
Please respond in writing. Tell us in detail about the certain legislative amendments that could improve your work. All right, on that note, Honourable Mantash, you've got a minute. Thank you.
Yeah, Chairperson, just one question. I just wanted to check when Ms. Bosch is saying they want to take everyone along, is there any advocacy program that takes the rural people along with you so that they can join and enjoy the good work that the NCT is doing? Thank you.
Thank you. Just on that, what we've been doing at this stage, as we said, in terms of our future plans for our rural people, we'll continue with our motion boards. So of course, that is the plan, because the numbers in the rural areas are normally also very small in relation. We get our bulk filings from your major cities. So what we've done in all these the cities there, we've had a big workshop for our filing parties here in Cape Town, where we invited basically, we used the NCR database to invite all the debt counselors and all the credit providers to, you know, to that specific workshop, as well as in the Gauteng area. And we are also having specific like meetings at this stage with specific groups also have indicated that they would want us to look at a template. So that's more in relation to the automation, that we would want to take those parties of access to automation into that process. Can I answer?
Maybe you could perhaps look, review the question that was raised and come back with a more expanded response to the committee. I think that would cover it from all angles, because you can appreciate actually the motivation in that regard, all right? At this point, Ms. Bosch and certainly Mr. Nombeta, Ms. Moodley, and Professor Dumisa, thank you very much for coming and sharing that with us. But I think, yes, we are concerned that the work of an NCT is in line, and there was one other question which I should have asked, which can come back to us in writing. What is the relationship you have with a national credit regulator? You know, what sort of healthy relationship or unhealthy relationship have you got? Thank you. Members, I did indicate that the Honourable Mantash would just give us 2 or so minutes on the, is it the launch of this, not launch, but the revitalization of the industrial park of Queen's Dust Industria. So please go ahead. When did it occur?
Thanks, Chairperson. I was privileged to be part of it, of this revitalization, a launch of the first phase of the Queen's Industria, Chairperson. It happened yesterday in Queenstown. 22.5 million has been spent, and my assessment was that we got good value for money, Chairperson, in that project, because already inside the past, although it is only the phase 1A, because that industrial park is composed of two parks that come from different backgrounds. The one in the deeper Transkei and the one in the border region. So it is only the border region industrial park that has been revitalized so far with the 22.5 million, where they have done the fencing, a state-of-the-art fencing. CCTV cameras have been installed, a guard's house where the CCTV cameras are, ablution facilities, you know, it's really value for money, Chairperson. I was amazed to find out that even in that one that has not been revitalized, there are businesses that are already operating, which for the people of that area gives hope that there's life, there will be economic activity as we go along.
Sure.
71 jobs have been created so far in the revitalization, the initial stage. I'm not mentioning the employment inside by those companies that are already operating.
Yeah.
71 jobs have been created. Some contractors from that area, the small emerging contractors, have benefited. But I was not pleased, Chairperson, with the fact that the main company, the main contractor, was not from that area. I'm not saying it is wrong to take a contractor from any place in the Eastern Cape, but I think our main aim is to ensure that the people of that area benefit out of it so that we can eliminate poverty and give them confidence. I understand that there are, you know, procurement processes, but that does not justify the fact that you can go to Port Elizabeth and bring a contractor from to Queenstown, whereas there are people in Queenstown with the same capacity of doing work. there are black industrialists operating inside, the parts, especially in the Berlin area. There's a company called Black Dot. It's a manufacturing company. They do printing, they design. I can show you pictures later on. In the Quindastra, there's already a plant of Kiza, the manufacturing that drink, where the average of drinks, yes, and yogurt. Remember that area that is an agricultural area. There are farmers around, they produce milk, but the bulk of that milk is still currently processed in Kucha, which I think the revitalization of this park will now bring that milk back. And cheese will be manufactured in Queenstown. Chairperson, the economy of Queenstown will never be the same again with the revitalization of such a park. The region and the business people around there are so excited. But they still have a lot, the department still has a lot to do because they have to integrate the two parks, the former Transkei and the border one. The bigger problem is that in between them, there's that special development was there as well, but there's a deep site in between the two, which still has to be closed down, and that will require resources. A deep site. That has to be closed down, and because there will be no business that will go to an area that is health-wise not conducive. There's, on the other side of the road, there's a graveyard, which also, I think, needs to be closed down and removed from that area. But, you know, the life will never be the same.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mantash, for that. I'm sorry I couldn't go, but, you know, some of us had prior arrangements in our constituencies. But thank you for going and giving us that report. But we must just monitor that and see how long it takes them to manage to remove the tip, as well as address the graveyards, because the cemetery is never an easy issue to resolve. That I can tell you, it's not going to be done tomorrow. There's a lot of consultation that's going to happen. And just because we do need to close, Honourable Mantash?
The other challenge, Chairperson, will be that the Twizza Company is already raising concerns of
energy
constraints.
Okay, well, we'll take that.
And my take is that maybe the department has to consult with other sister departments to come closer to those people, because the two municipalities alone can never be able to carry the burden. If we are really serious about the business in that area and the attraction of more business, this will be critical.
Well, I think we're going to have to look at some of the renewables and other measures which the Northern Cape have done, solar energy and the like. But thank you very much. Members, on that particular note, let's take a 7-minute tea break there, and let's try and be back at 11:30. Thank you very much. September 21st, is that right? And you said you've now gotten a... Yes. You will recall, members, that the register had been mislaid. Do you remember? It has since been located. We can never have that again. Right. So we never ever adopted them, which we couldn't. But we had been through them, and to refresh your minds, you never had a problem, but we could not adopt them. And we have someone to propose adoption. Honourable Williams?
No, Chair.
Okay.
On page one, it appears that under apologies that Mr. McPherson has been put down as the ANC. Thank you.
Well, you see, you've now upset two parties. Well, I mean, I don't know if you know about our induction process, Honourable McPherson. No, it's not a question of being upset. I'm always ready to process new members and induct them. Anyway, please, can we amend that? I didn't see it the first time, so how does it reappear this? I mean, how does it come in now? Just flew in. Was that what happens when you go to Johannesburg? Anyway, right. Then, Honourable Shabangu, you know, we've got such a strong leadership there. So, page 2. Now, on a serious note, let's just check these. Page 3. But effectively, the problem was the attendance register. Can we then, with that amendment, and may I suggest you replace that page and give it to us again? I don't want this going down in history. Right. Propose that, please, Honourable Williams, do you? Yes, seconded by? I'm not going to say anything. You guys must talk on mic.
Thanks so much, Professor.
Thank you.
All on mic. First of November, that's the next block to come up.
These are very recent. This is exactly how we should be receiving minutes within 10 days. And here they are, page 1. Page 2. Page 3.
These minutes are packaged, because I'll give an example. 4.3.1, I mean, it says that,
hang on,
it says
4.3.1,
yeah, it says the committee raised concerns about the proposal, and it said and it was of the view that the matter should be further explored. I mean, the way I recall that meeting is that the committee actually was quite against that idea, and then people spoke out quite strongly, and in fact the media reported that the committee rejected that proposal, and now it's being put in the minutes. It was, well, you know, we were kind of concerned, we're thinking about it, we're unsure, we want to talk about it more. But the committee was quite emphatic about its view on that day. So can you just explain to me how these minutes are captured and put into such a vague manner in which actually contradicts the discussion that was had?
No, we don't put a blow by blow in which we all accept, all right? But the issue is this. When you say the committee did X, as it was, the point is, we cannot say every member of the committee. There were members who spoke up, including myself. That does not mean because you say something, I say something, and a third person says something, that the entire committee agrees. At that point, if that was the case, we would have been said, are there any objections? Sometimes people are quiet. They say nothing. And saying nothing doesn't mean an assumption that they agree with you. And I think we need to just be aware of that. But I do take your point. I'm not finished, but I see the hands, right, you're all raising your hands. But the issue was this. At the end, my own notes on the matter is, you know, when I say it was rejected, that was the interpretation of the media, that it was rejected. What the committee did say, and indeed I was the one to say it, is that we put our positions forward for various reasons. We did not think it a good idea to shift up to 21. Some were of the view because we can't even enforce 18. Others were of the view that at 18 one could do certain things, and why not be able to also drink at that age? But there was no sort of, yes, we rejected the what was asked in that committee was for the DDG to come back to the committee, because we did have certain queries on the matter. Somebody, I forget who, asked for, do you have a comparative study done in Africa? Because everything we were being given was done overseas and not in Africa. So when I read the newspaper article, and it was almost like we'd taken some sort of decision, I have no disagreement with how I was reflected, make no mistake, because I know what I said. But what I say, per se, in a comment, is not what the committee decision is. And so in that respect, I think that what was may have been missing here was the fact that we did ask the DTI to come back. And I thought it was here. And I think it implies that we're coming back today. So I do think it's a correct reflection. There wasn't, yes, it's a wholehearted thing, but we do want to look at it further. Yes, Honourable MacPherson? And then I'll take your point, Honourable Mkongi.
Thanks, Chair. Well, my first point is you're correct that it is admitted that we had asked the department to provide information. I had actually specifically asked also that the department provide all of its research that it relied on. That's not yet. The second thing is that I asked the department provide all of its legal opinion that it had relied upon. That is not in the minutes, and I still don't have either of those. The third thing is, you know, words matter when it comes to minutes, because it's the only reflection of the record that we have, unless we go back to the Hansard. Now, all the minister reflect that the committee raised concerns, for me that is a very fluffy way of actually describing that robust conversation that we had.
Yeah.
And, you know, to say
I
that...
I certainly agree it was robust.
Yeah. And, you know, to say that the matter should be further explored. Be definitive on what that point actually is, because I just don't feel that point actually reflects the committee's views or discussion of that particular point.
Thank you,
Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Mkongi. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm glad that you said in your concluding remarks that you would propose that the DGI must come back with further information.
Yes.
You know, because, Chairperson, I proposed in one of the meetings that we must have a paragraph or anything that we can call it within minutes that speaks about decisions. Yes. I'm saying I propose that we need to have that part, you know, because it does not confuse our proposals in terms of what needs to be done. And on the matter of age, generally there was a general agreement, even if we said the department must go back. But the spirit, as I spoke about the spirit, was on the matter of age. And we agreed. So I'm comfortable with saying that we're going to wait for the department to come, and those minutes will reflect on the decisions that we take as a portfolio committee.
There are two things that I think we can do here, and what I did appreciate, Honourable MacPherson, is how you finally were characterised the meeting. There was a very robust engagement. There was, without a doubt. And I think it needs to say that. All right? Number one. Number two, there were three things requested, and we would all agree on that. And I think we've already spelled that out, that we requested, study in Africa or whatever. You asked for, what was it again, just to refresh my memory on...
Empirical
research. Right, that's it. And in fact, the third thing I asked for was this, from a neuropsychological point of view, the issue around the brain, you know, undergoing further development between 21 and 25. Now, we asked, you know, for this. Now, I am led to understand, as of this morning, Now, these were the minutes then, that some of this information is at hand. But let's just get through the minutes, because these are the minutes. Let's put this, collect the minutes to reflect what we have said. No, let me just get this on record, Honourable MacPherson, because now...
I also requested the legal opinions that the DDG had referred to matters of law, particularly the issue of liability. He was going to provide that to us.
All right.
Now, just make sure we get this quite accurate then, okay? Now, this is what should be in the minutes. Do we agree? And should they be amended accordingly? So no one's, I don't think there's any real disagreement about what you're saying, all right? Because yes, there was for me a view, a strong view, but at the same time we wanted further information about it. Right. Now that was on page 3. Was there any other point you wish to raise on 3? No, committee business. We gave the letters and the adjournment. And of course, the attendance register, please check. On that particular note, can we have somebody, and I do want the amendments to come back to us. We can pass this, but I want this to be back to on a Friday. All right, let's receive it at least on Thursday. Can we have somebody to propose the adoption, and let's have it on record.
Chairperson, I move for the adoption of the amendment.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Can we have you seconding that with those amendments, Honourable MacPherson?
I second them, thank you.
Yeah. With that amendment, and let's get that those amendments recorded there. Thank you very much. That's that lot. Now, I understand, arising out of these minutes, Mr. Medina, you may not have received it, but there... I believe Ms. Naidu, could you just indicate to us on record, Ms. Naidu, what is now available?
Ms. Fox, we've given one of the recent documents and the legal opinions.
Right, members, you see, and that'll take a little bit of a process to get it organized through the committee channels, and you'll get a copy of that. Is that in order? Right. I believe you had a little media shindig yesterday. Right. You know, we're all on top of it here, I see. Right. What's the next set of minutes, please? All right. Those are the two sets of minutes. We're right on track. And now let's look at the program again, just to reflect what we are up to. Let's look at the 9th. It looks like you were intending to hold another subcommittee then. Is that correct, Mr. Williams? Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, that's correct. We will have our subcommittee tomorrow.
Are you all in agreement
yes.
with that? Okay, no debate. Right. 11th. I just want to remind you, we're coming up with a very special day, the 11th of the 11th. Some of your forebears, including our very own black soldiers, were in that war. Some of us forget that. They got very late recognition from Her Majesty. Very late. I was at that service. But yes, they finally got it a few years back. So let's not forget it, and I think that's one reason why you may see a couple of poppies around the place. You know, that famous poem by Wilfred Owen, I think it is, in Flanders Field. Very famous, who wrote it? Of course, you're recently out of college, right?
John McRae.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hilton. The 15th, subcommittee, engagement with stakeholders with respect to measures, debt relief, 15th, that is the engagement. All right, now I'm looking, are you up on this?
Yes, I'm
with the committee? Has Mr. Hermans briefed you? Has he briefed you, Mr. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I wasn't briefed, and fundamentally what's happened is he's just put in dates for the Wednesdays, but the Wednesday meetings will start at 10 o'clock, not at 8:30.
Well, you know that's your decision with Mr. Hermans, all right, and in line with your members. Yes. Well, that's what's worrying me. I'm given this, and of course we need to know the status of this. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Chair, why is the full committee dealing with the same topic on Friday? Or is that just going to be a subcommittee meeting? This coming Friday, the full committee is dealing with debt relief. Should that
be? You know, over here, I'm just beginning to wonder what the status is of this program. Did you check, Mr. Medina? No, you can't just say he just gave it to you. No, you must ask.
Let me get this off record. Yes. DDG?
Yeah. On record.
The on record.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, I just wanted to know what will be the DTI saying. What will be, on the 11th, what will be the DTI saying together with the NCR, different from what the subcommittee is doing?
So that's fine on the 11th, but I think we were already on to stakeholders. You understand? I saw stakeholders coming up here. Yes. So on the 15th, stakeholders, Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, I think that we shouldn't look at anything to do with the subcommittee until I've engaged with the secretary, because it seems that this has just been thrown at this committee without any engagement whatsoever, and I don't think that we should accept it, and we should say thank you, but we want to talk first, and then when the subcommittee has got a program, then we can present that program. It's going to be a proper program. What's going to happen is members of the subcommittee will start talking about this program in this meeting, and I don't think that's appropriate. I think we should. Tomorrow we're having a meeting. Tomorrow morning we're having a meeting, and we should just deal with it all there. Thank you.
All right, but that's the subcommittee. Where, as far as this committee is concerned, we already know that the DTI are coming here on the 11th. That we do know. All right? They're going to give us the official position coming in on this, how the department sees this. All right? Yes, Honourable Hill-Lewis.
But that's what the DDG has just asked. That's exactly what the department is doing in the subcommittee. So why are we duplicating? And let's just make that let's cancel the subcommittee meeting and that's exactly what the DDG is going to come and talk to the subcommittee about.
Well, what we're going to do is this. Let me take the decision here. There will be a committee meeting on Friday. What we can say is you will know what it is tomorrow. All right? Dealing with. I think, where did Mr. Medina go? Yes. All right. Now, Mr. Medina, don't move just yet. I was saying that we are having a meeting on Friday. Let's get that out the way, all right? And just refresh my memory, Honourable Quirinoff, you know, I just haven't got my book with me on your sort of application for leave. Which Friday is it again?
11th.
Oh, it is the 11th, yeah. All right. Thank you very much. I thought it was, yes. All right, that's the 11th. So the 16th, I'm leaving the subcommittee in your hands, Honourable Williams. Let's look at the 22nd. I do know what I have said to Mr. Hermans, and that is that we want something coming back to this committee here on the week of the 15th, which is a Tuesday. So I need to discuss that further with him to see what he has put down. Because I really didn't think we are in any position to engage stakeholders. Do do you? Absolutely. You know what I mean? I just don't think we are, and I'm making that as a statement. Then we've got Tuesday the 22nd, the Promotion of Investment Act. That is definitely on the table, all right? Then we've got formal consideration of the report on the memorandum. Now, we put that there, but it's also coming in again on the 25th, I think it is, 24th, which is a Thursday, a special meeting. We want to set 2 days in case there's some form of delay, you see. But the 22nd is what we're looking at already. And then we're looking at the formal, you've got that one down, of this, and the NRCS. Then the NCC, and SANIF, and then the second, briefing by the NGB and NAMESA. And then we will have, in the third week or fourth week of November, we're going to have the projected program for January and February. But what we do need to hear from you is, you know, I would have thought that it may be possible to make an early start on this debt relief issue. That's one idea. The other is the promotion, not the promotion, the what are the actors, this copyright one, performance, the performers. Exactly where is that, Ms. Naidu?
Yeah, that's still with the state law advisor. The DG has written to Mr. Enver Daniels yesterday asking for the status of that bill.
Asking to get it out of the archives. But yes, Honourable MacPherson.
I think for January, you know, I mean, I think that there's actually oversight work to be done as well. And I would hope that that's something that you or the committee would be considering.
Now, I'm coming to that. But I'm giving you the three or four things that we would have to begin to deal with. The other issue is we were unable to do as much oversight as we had planned this year. We only did the early part of the year. And it would appear as if that's all this committee can ever manage, as you can see the way our schedule goes. So I think that the Manco and I would look at a few ideas. I want you to have a few ideas yourself so that you can come in with those on Friday and say, look, what about this, what about that? All right, that's the one approach to the matter. And at least get our oversight effectively done. Seeing as what we did this year, we actually went to KZN, if I'm not mistaken, and we were somewhere else. Where was it? Was it only KZN? Yes. Now, we have done in this term, we have done two provinces only. So it may be time for us to look at an issue, a critical issue in the committee that we need to exercise oversight on and to look at that. And we do want to try and do two or three things and not one issue. So I'd like us all to think of that one and come back on the issue. The other one is to do with all the overseas visits, as it were. I need not tell you about the budget constraints, even within the departments themselves. But the minister has indicated that, of course, from time to time, he would want to look at issues around the WTO. But again, this is a whole, you know, budget constraint issue, as I understand it. But if I'm not mistaken, Honourable Hill News, you've been to one of those, haven't you? And they are very constructive, worthwhile, and one does learn more. So that may be a possibility, and we would have hoped that at some point we could have done something to do with manufacturing in a part of the world where that is making some progress in that regard. Is there anything else? Because I would like to close the committee. It's committee business, you see, adjourn it. everyone, Mr. Herman, look, we have this, and I want us to discuss this in Manco. So I'd like you to remain behind so we sort out a Manco. All right. Can we please, I'll find out from two of our honorable members at the back, and that is the Honorable Anton Elvis. I know that you also got a very tight schedule, and I'm pleased you, at least, you know, you've committed yourself to participating in the debt relief one, but that we would want to know way in advance about the Friday issue, you know, your attendance on that day, you see, so that we avoid, you know, we can take account of decisions and that kind of thing. For yourself, Honorable Esther Hazen, I know that it was your wife's illness that prevented you from attending, and we do hope she has improved. Has she improved? Yes. Well, I'm glad to hear that. So, on that note, we're adjourned until Friday. And please consult your notices with respect to the time and venue. Thank you.